Hello and welcome back to Joe's Art History Podcast, a podcast that celebrates all things art historical with me, your host and resident art historian, Joe McLaughlin. Hello, hello, welcome back. It is episode 65 and this week we are talking all things fauvism. Now, what is fauvism, I hear you ask? Well, fauvism, or the fauves, was a name applied to a group of artists who worked together for a very short period of time between 1905 and 1910. You'll know one of the names, absolutely, Henri Matisse and André Dreyan. Les Fauves, or as we translate that, means the wild beasts. And it was a term coined by an art critic when he gazed upon what Matisse and Dreyan were producing in this short period of time. Actually, quite a lot of the time they were working side by side. And it was their bold, expressive use of colour and brushstrokes. It's an incredibly interesting chat, and who we have as a guest today is the wonderful Lois Cordelia, who is a community artist and speed painter. Lois is so passionate about fauvism, and it very much resonates with the work that she produces and her bold and beautiful use of colour. I would definitely say go check Lois out. She does incredible work and really quite interesting to see that she produces works live in front of audiences. I'd actually never come across a speed painter before or someone that calls themselves a community artist, and I just love it. I think it's great. You will love this chat. We have a wonderful conversation full of passion, mutual admiration for this group of painters, and they really did pave the way for some of the big ticket painters. It's kind of seen as an extension of post-impressionism in terms of a movement, but it really did pave the way for the likes of Cubism, Expressionism, and German Expressionism as well, which is a lovely, lovely thing. So without further ado, sit back and relax as Lois and I discuss fauvism. Enjoy. Okay, so the fauvism, fauves. I'm so thrilled that you answered my open call and this was the subject that you wanted to talk about because, and I'm going to be very, very honest, I cannot remember studying movement in art history. And it's something that during lockdown, I was like going back to like my old books and like really sort of looking at different sort of periods and styles in art history. And then I came across this term and I was like, what the hell is this? And how an art historian for 10 plus years? And I don't know who these people are. And I think it's because it was such a powerful movement. I myself have completely missed this because it's such a short movement within art history, but it led on from, or it led to really, really big punchy art movements that I think get way more airtime than what the fauvism movement does. What's your thoughts on?
Yeah, I totally agree, Jo. Firstly, thank you for having me on, and really, really excited to talk about a group of artists who blew my mind about 20 years ago when I first started painting. And I should say I'm a freelance artist myself, so it's not only, in my case, not just something that's been a huge inspiration in my life, but also in my career. The Fauves were a group of artists working in the early years of the 1900s. We're talking particularly Henri Matisse and André Dreyan. The term, it was applied to them disparagingly by the critic Louis Vauxhall in 1905, I think. And he was obviously horrified by their use of what he thought was very wild and strident colours. And so to me, that term, the fauves, the wild animals, is quite the reverse. It's a real inspiration. I personally, I love animals as well as anything else. And the whole concept of wildness and rewilding and all this sort of thing. So a sort of raw bestiality in art is something that to me is very valuable. And in terms of colour, yeah, as I said, they completely blew my mind. I would say that their work today still looks extremely contemporary and, you know, it doesn't look out of place. It wouldn't look out of place in a modern art gallery.
I think that's such a great point, actually, that you look at these things, and I, particularly for the first work that we're going to talk about, 1905, it's so punchy, the colours are painted so well. And what I find really interesting is that this was following on from the Impressionists. So this was sort of a response to their use of colour and working outside. But what the Fauves did was disregard using colour in a realistic sense. And it was something that they used to express their emotions and start to lead the way towards abstraction. But because it was such a jump in terms of vividness of colour, people really didn't know what to think about it to begin with. And I love this idea. It's the wild animals.
Yes.
It's incredible. And you've picked a really iconic first work. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about this? And it's particularly important to you as well, which I love. I love when people come on and say to me, I've picked this work because actually this is the thing that kickstarted it all. I think it's fantastic. So yeah, a little bit about it.
Yeah, this was precisely, for me personally, the piece that kickstarted my own painting style. And I think back in 2000, I was in the middle of my A-levels, including A-level art. My art teacher, Mr. Emery, at Northgate High School in Ipswich.
Shout out.
he came in one morning and he realised that back then I was obsessed with sort of black and white monochrome pictures and, you know, drawing and very detailed work. And he said, Lois, you need to do something more sophisticated and use some colour. I went home, I dug out my acrylics and started messing around. But I also had back then a bunch of art history journals, which I had found very cheaply in a charity shop. And I started just flicking through, and you know how the page just sort of falls open on something and it just grabs you. And this was the portrait that grabbed me. It is a portrait, let's get this straight, a portrait of Henri Matisse by his friend and fellow artist, André Durand. And I think what grabbed me, I mean, the colours are, I don't know how to, I can't think of a good enough adjective. They really burst forth. They are very wild. The blue and the other colours, they just, I don't know, they're so contrasting and full of expressive quality. Yeah, as I said already, it just blew my mind. And that moment I knew I had to find out more about who this was, the sort of the movement of it. I started looking more into both of their works. And I think the other portrait that particularly grabbed me was a portrait by Matisse. I think it's called the Green Stripe. That might be more of a nickname, but it's a picture of a woman with basically a green stripe right down her nose. And the way that I've ever since painted has been, you know, to basically start with a neutral concept of colour. I often work from a black and white photograph, if I'm working from a photograph, and then that gives me no colour information except sort of tonal values. And I have that vibrancy, weirdly enough. And it's a startling style all its own. I think back in the early 1900s, it was really mind-blowing because people wouldn't have seen that at all, and hence why they were nicknamed the wild animals.
Yeah, and can you imagine seeing a portrait like, I mean, something like this now, we're still like, oh my gosh, it's fantastic, it's beautiful. But back then, it really must have blown the socks off people, and really people as well, because I don't know if we mentioned, but the artworks were in a salon in an exhibition in Paris, and they were hung beside very traditional sort of marble sculptures. So even that itself as like a surrounding
sort of torn apart. Like,
Exactly.
it's gonna pop on your
Yeah.
screen.
Yeah, sort of contrasting juxtaposition. Yeah, that must have been quite a statement in itself.
And it's just fantastic. And what's so important that for this is 1905 is the year that is said that Fauvism was founded. And it was Henri Matisse and André Derain. I keep going to say André Breton, and I don't know why. I've literally written Derain so many times to be like, it's not André Breton. So André Breton, they are two of the founders of this movement. And I just love that they were together and it was like a summer of experimentation in this
Exactly.
seaside town that they went to. And
Yeah.
this is one of the works that sort of kick-started it all. And I love as well that they very much that you can see in this where he's more or less just emptied the paint straight from the tube.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, it's so good, particularly around about the forehead. I don't know what it is,
Yes.
but it
Yeah.
just. Oh, it makes me tingle. I love it.
Exactly. Exactly. It's lovely what you said, Joe, just now about the idea of those artists working side by side, probably in the same studio environment, painting each other, painting portraits of one another. And I think, you know, in my experience as an artist, some of the happiest, most creative periods of my life have been just simply working in the company of other artists, friends usually. And, you know, often doing portraits of each other and experimenting and just having fun and laughing. And you can sort of see that in those works that we're looking at here.
No, you can. And I think people forget that as an artist, it can be a very solitary thing. Like
Yeah.
you're in your studio and you're, yes, okay, you're inspired by the world around you and by people, but realistically, it's a very solitary occupation. It's you and a canvas or you and a block of clay or you and whatever material you choose to interact and shape in some way. But I love this idea of them both in the studio and just playing as well. And it's something I think we don't really think
Yeah.
about as artists playing and experimenting, but that's exactly what happens when you're
Yeah.
making movements. And I can see Matisse here as sort of like almost kind of pulling a face, being a wee bit serious, like almost posing for it, which I love. I think is great. I think it's
Yes.
such a fabulous,
Yeah.
fabulous trip.
It is a stunning portrait, you know, even regard disregarding any of the color that we've just been talking about. It is a beautiful portrait. I think you're absolutely spot on with the word play, incidentally. Play as a key concept in my own work. And I think, yes, I can absolutely imagine them playing about and just, like we said, just having fun.
Yeah, and not being like precious with like application of paints. And I think you can see that freedom in how thickly things have been applied, how fast some of the brush strokes are. I just think it's so beautiful. And it's actually a work that I have probably come across it, but never have spent enough time with it. And this is actually in the permanent collection at Tate in London. I'm not sure if it's on display. And if it would be, oh my goodness, I was going to say it would be in Tate Britain, but it wouldn't be because it's not British art. So it'd be probably Tate Modern if it was on display, but this is owned by Tate. Incredible work. So hopefully I'll get to see it in real life, being
Yeah.
London. That would be great. And I'll ping you an email.
Brilliant. Oh, please do.
This is like a really great example of like the beginnings of the movement. And the next few works we're going to talk about are two Matisse works, the master himself, the sort of the godfather of Fauvism, if you will. And as we sort of briefly mentioned, this sort of led on to lots of, sort of very slowly led the way into abstraction. And Matisse is someone, again, that idea of play, he really did push the boundaries of his practice and what painting could be, which I really. And the second work that you wanted to talk about today was the dance, La Danse. Just one of, if not the most iconic work from Matisse. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I sent you the photo of it on the wall in the gallery, which
Yes.
shows the enormous scale of it. And we should just mention that it is huge. I think there's a little push chair or baby's pram or something in the picture beside it, and it dwarfs that. for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a painting of basically a circle of dancing figures, all nude, and you see this incredible undulating movement in the painting as they're spinning around in the dance, sort of, and you can sort of feel this energy of just being immersed in this dance that goes on and rotates. I think it's been said that it depicts the idea of joie de vivre, the joy of living, the joy of life, of youth, and so on. It's very bold colours, as we've been talking a lot about colours. These brilliant oranges that sort of are very complementary with the background colours. It's a painting that, to me, I mean, it appeals to me on lots of levels. It is beginning to sort of verge into the idea of abstraction as well. So the figures are no longer realistic. They're quite, dare I use the word, crude, but in a really raw, beautiful way. And that sort of really blew my mind, because it was the first time I was really encountering that sort of art. I think the movement of it is something that you just sort of feel, I don't know, sort of almost
drawn in, or
drawn in. Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Drawn into the movement of it in a way that you sort of sense the sort of timelessness of it. It's a very sort of surreal picture in that sense of being quite timeless. The other reason that it really grabs me is because of the subject matter and the theme, because dance is something that has a huge presence to me in my life. And I dance every day doing everything, including painting. I should say I learnt to enjoy dancing years ago when I was a student in Edinburgh in very cold student digs, and it was literally the only way to keep warm. So the more I danced, the more I realised just how powerful and inspirational it could be. And I think it's relatively rare that you see movement of dance depicted in art. You know, it's quite common to see dramatic battle scenes and, you know, very gentle, you know, draped nudes and things, but to see dancers in a painting is relatively rare. And I think he was possibly one of the first to sort of think about capturing movement in a painting. And I think that is, again, I mean, that's a huge part of my work. And I think for that reason, that painting, you know, it really, really grabs me as well.
Yeah, I think it's so beautiful. And what's so lovely is, again, when do you ever just spend 5-6 minutes, one, talking about a work of art, two, just really, really looking at it, even on a screen? So it's been so lovely to hear your take on it and look at it and just feel so compelled. There is this thing where there's a small break in the circle of, because all the dancers are holding hands, and it's the first time I've ever really realized that two of the dancers, there is a small break. I kind of just want to grab one of their hands and sort of step into it. What I didn't realize with this one, because it's such an iconic work from Matisse, that it was one of his first real big commissions. It was commissioned by this Russian art collector, and it was supposed to be a series of three. And that's something that I didn't know about this, that it's part of a triptych.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me as an artist whenever I see an example of a painting where there are multiple versions of it, and the slight differences and the similarities, obviously. Yeah. Off the top of my head, I can't quite picture the other.
So the others are, so I can't remember what it is, but one of them is music, and they're all, so they all have the same sort of green foreground.
Yes, that's
blue
right.
Blue background. Yeah. But they're very different. This one is the best, in my opinion. I think it's...
Yeah. Yeah. I think, like I've said, I think the reason that it grabs me so deeply is because of the subject matter as well as anything else. Yeah.
And I think if we were to compare it to the previous work, here you have bold, bright, contrasting colours, and the colours completely take over the canvas, and there's no realism to it in the respect of colours matching what it would be in real life. But it's not this short, sharp brushstrokes, quick brushstrokes compared to the previous, but there seems to be he's progressing in style. And I think it's a lovely link into like the piece we're about to talk about next. But you can also start to see, yeah, just a change in his style and how he applies paint to a canvas. So I think that's really interesting as well, that this was painted 1910, so 5 years after Cubism was founded, if you will. And yeah, there seems to be this movement away from the application, but the in terms of technique, but color is really the core of this movement, which is, it's just gorgeous. That blue is just incredible.
Like, isn't it?
And I, in my head, I'm like, where are they? Are they dancing at the edge of a pool and the green is like the water?
Yeah.
And then they're dancing beside water. I read this thing where it was talking about how the circle dancing can be seen as something that's quite ritualistic. It can be seen as something quite primitive. And I don't know if that's just the way that he's drawn the figures.
It's true. I have a lot of friends in the circle dance community.
Really?
Yes, definitely. It's not something I do myself particularly. I'm very freestyle when I dance, but I love watching circle dance. It is one of the most satisfying phenomena, I think, to watch. And if you're not sort of quite as radically individualistic as me, then you, yes, by all means, you know, join in with it and feel absolutely immersed in the rhythm of it and the beauty of it. And I think that comes across so beautifully in this painting. Yeah, the whole idea of circle dance is of the sort of community of almost family holding hands, tied together sort of in a circle and still moving and rotating. And it's sort of, it, you know, it echoes the very folksy and rustic and rural. And
I love that.
Was he, you know what I mean? So,
I love that. I think it's beautiful. And actually, it's made me think of you talking about circle dances. And I was like, I don't think I've done a circle dance. But actually, as you'll know, having studied in
Cayley's.
Cayley's. That is that is the dictionary definition of a group dance, of a
absolutely,
circle dance.
Absolutely. I think most areas of the world have their own form of circle dance, maybe not quite so obviously in some places, but yeah, it's a very timeless tradition that goes back, you know, a long, long way.
And do you paint dancers in your own practice? Is that something that you do, or is it more?
I do, yes. I think dance in one form or another is sort of inherent in all of my work, and its movement. I find it very hard to paint something that is sort of very static. And I think that's, to me, it's all about the spirit. It's, if you like, when spirit becomes matter, if it becomes too sort of rigid, it becomes like a fossil and it becomes brittle and breaks apart. Whereas if you keep the, basically what I'm saying is when, as an artist, when I try to capture a sense of movement, and I think that's what Matisse has done here beautifully, he's not sort of set it too firmly in stone, so to speak. He's left these raw edges. He's left the sort of, you know, left some of it to imagination, and the mind fills in the rest. It fills in the movement. And, you know, I think a lot of artists, if they were to paint something like that, they would take a photograph of a dancer or dancers and they would do it meticulously detailed work. And you think, actually, that, I mean, it's beautiful, but it doesn't capture the movement, to me at least. You know, it's too sort of precise. It's too rigid. It's like that fossil that I spoke of. And so that the spirit, it can no longer move and breathe in that context.
Oh, I love that. And really interesting that you said there, but most people would work from a photograph. I read this really interesting thing in preparation for the recording, where essentially Matisse, essentially because photography was becoming this sort of newly used thing, and it was invented in like the, I think it was like the 1880s. And photography was becoming this thing that was being used more and more. And in terms of him sort of paring down his styles and not really giving or painting as detailed as perhaps what he once was, his response was, I don't need to do that. That's what photography is here for. And it can do it quicker and a million times more intricate than what I can as a painter. So he saw the development of this new technology as sort of freeing him from perhaps an obligation in having things, which I really love, because I think most people, you fear new inventions, don't you? You're sort of like, oh God, like if you think of like NFTs and digital art, there was that three, 4 years ago where we were like, oh, it's going to completely take over the art world and no one's going to paint anymore. And you sort of fear it, where that hasn't happened. But I really loved that that was his attitude. He was like, great, well, this thing's going to do all the details for me. So
yeah,
fun sort of paring everything down, which I thought was great. And another thing, just picking up on what you said there about how the mind fills the blanks. I love that. I have never thought of that when looking at a Matisse work, but it's so true, because the minute you said that, I was like, yeah, you're right, because there's no shadows in any of these figures. So how on earth does my mind know that these works are moving? It's wild. It's like an illusion. It's like a trick of the eye.
Yeah, I think from my own experience, I remember distinctly once going to a life drawing class, maybe a couple actually, where the model was moving the whole time. I remember particularly attending one class where the model was dressed as a belly dancer. You know, they were forced not to sit there and do meticulous detailed studies, but to capture that sense of movement. And I think, again, that's what we're sort of talking about here, not sort of setting things too much in stone, but preserving that initial fleeting sense of movement that inspired the artwork in the first place.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And I love the idea of having someone that moves around in drawing classes. As someone that I'm not gifted in terms of painting or drawing, but I think that's great fun because it keeps you on your toes, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And literally in some ways. And I should say, though, that a lot of the artists I heard moaning and saying, oh, I can't capture this. You know, she's moving the whole time. Why can't she just sit still? And I think that, you know, that is such a good discipline to force yourself out of that comfort zone of, I've got a stationary thing in front of me, I'm going to paint it bit by bit. You know, actually, we can capture more than that. And like you were saying about photography versus painting, I mean, when I was younger, I had much more of a sort of photographic style of art. And I think it's something we naturally these days develop as artists. We are, you know, we have to develop drawing skills. It's fair enough. And so, you know, the more virtuosic you become in drawing, the more photographic and realistic your work looks. But I did an exhibition and a friend of mine came along and all he said was, you need to do more than what a camera can do. And I've never forgotten that. That was the most helpful bit of advice I think I've ever received. Yeah, you have to do more than what a camera can do, because otherwise you might as well have a photo, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. It's a great point. And I suppose picking up on that point of, you know, Matisse sort of rebelling against the details because of the camera, it leads us beautifully to the final work that you've picked. And I was so excited that you picked this because I love this series of collages.
Yeah.
I think Matisse was, and I'm not the only one, collage has never been done the same since him. He completed it and then just everyone else has been trying to catch up since, I think. And what I love about this, and we're talking about a piece called Icarus, and it's a beautiful collage, it's the first time black is really a dominant colour in the painting, I think, even though the background is gorgeous, but black is really key here in terms of a colour. It's almost sort of anti-fauvism, if you will, to suggest that it's a colour. But what made you pick Icarus, despite the
So, again, lots of reasons. I'll try and remember them all. So I should begin by explaining that when Matisse was in his latter years, he was bedridden. And so he was no longer able to paint very easily. So he asked for huge sheets of paper. And we are talking sort of wall poster size. They are enormous paper cuts that he did. He asked for huge sheets of paper, coloured paper and shears. And there are photos I think I've seen of him in bed cutting these things out and then sticking them, well, somebody else sticking them beside his bed, which is a, you know, full image in itself. Just the fact that he was determined to keep going. And you can see the sort of development in his work there. But the, like you said, the black is really striking. Interesting. I should just mention that because in my art career, I did not do anything beyond, you know, I didn't take any formal art education beyond A-level art. And so my only art education, in inverted commas, beyond that was working part-time for 20 odd years as an art and studio assistant to a book illustrator, children's book illustrator, Jan Pienkowski, who did the Meg and Mog books. I don't know if you're familiar with.
Oh, yes, I know that.
Yeah, and haunted house pop-up books and things like that. But also the thing that I sort of was particularly interested in his work from being a child was his silhouettes, paper cuts, except, of course, I assumed they were paper cuts. I realized later that they were drawings, but leaving that detail aside, I worked with Jan for many years in his West London studio. And that was a huge privilege, I should say, to have done that. And one of the things that he said to me explains exactly what Matisse is doing here. Jan, I may misquote him slightly, but what he said was he never used black in his own work except as pure silhouette or as an outline. And I think in this case, we've got Icarus as this pure silhouette figure and this pure colour around him. And in Jan's words, this is the concept of stained glass, in a sense. Whether that's what Matisse had in mind, I don't know. But it's, again, it's the idea of black not sort of, not toning down, not sort of blackening, not polluting the colour spectrum of these pure, vivid colours. And so I think that has hugely influenced my own work to the extent that I very rarely, if ever, use black paint except as pure silhouette. It's a really interesting one. Again, it was something that my art teacher, Mr. Emery, stark image. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, a lot of Matisse's paper cuts have become some of the most iconic pieces.
Yeah.
You see them printed on postcards. And the other reason, well, one of the other reasons I've chosen that work is because of the subject matter, Icarus. I have a great love of Greek mythology and any mythology for that matter, but the story of Icarus, for those of you who need reminding, Daedalus, his father, built for himself and for Icarus, his son, these wings made of feathers stuck together with wax, and they were planning to escape across the water. Icarus flew too near the sun, which melted the wax, and he fell to his death. And it's a very poignant image of, to me, it's sort of, you know, it's symbolizing climbing too high in your ambitions and then sort of, you know, falling. But it's also a very beautiful image. It sort of reminds me in a lot of ways. You often see Icarus sort of depicted as falling, almost like the Pietà, the sort of the Christ figure, as sort of draped across Mary's knees in grief after his death and so on. So it's a very poignant, very moving image of this young man full of hope, full of energy, falling to his death with his wings, his dreams in tatters around him. And again, it's something that I've occasionally used in my, you know, that imagery in my own art for that reason, because it is such a powerful story apart from anything else.
Yeah, I just think he's done it so beautifully because it's such a tragic story, and yet there's something, if you don't know the title, there's something almost slightly joyous about this. I feel like it
yeah,
mistaken as a dancer.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
I find it really thought-provoking in that
yeah,
respect.
Absolutely. I think you're right. I think it is an incredibly life-affirming image.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the flip side of that coin is, you know, is Icarus falling to his death, or is he falling into glory and wonder and so on? There is that ambivalence there. And I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's just an incredible call. And this went on to become a series of works, which was published and put into a book of prints, if I'm correct, and lots of different topics. And the book was then produced and sort of sold. And there wasn't a huge run. And actually, when I was an intern, when I was a student at university, I did an internship at an auction house, and I would into the book department. And one of the sales I worked on, we got a copy of Jazz. This book is called Jazz. So I got to look at these 20 incredibly beautiful, bold coloured works that are within this book and read Matisse's thoughts on each of them. Just, yeah. So
magic.
Yeah. So I haven't seen this in so long. So, and when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, I know exactly what series it's such a beautiful work. So thank you for collecting this. It took me on a bit of a memory.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. I should say, actually, that when I worked for many years with Jan in his West London studio near Hammersmith, he, for many, many years in his studio, which was huge, I mean, it was the top floor of a four-floor Victorian mansion, and it was very, you know, sunlit and views of the Thames on one side and so on. And in right in the centerpiece was an enormous cheese plant. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a cheese plant so big. And this cheese plant, the leaves, the shape of the leaves used to put shadows across the walls. And Jan would always comment on these shadows and how beautiful they were, usually as a sort of way of procrastinating and not doing work. He would sort of look at these shadows and see things in them. But that was fascinating to me, until years later when I found this series of Matisse's work in his latter years of paper cutting, and quite a number of his paper cuts, of Matisse's paper cuts, feature the monster, the cheese plant leaves, very dististive shapes of cheese plant leaves. And there are photos. Yeah, there are definitely photos, I think, of Matisse's studio, and he has an enormous cheese plant. So this has a funny sort of relevance for me in a way as well.
It makes you think of that. Well, and if anything, it just means we all need a cheese plant, really.
Yes.
Inspire top artists and illustrators. Everyone immediately down tools and go buy a cheese plant.
Absolutely.
And Lois, it's been so, so fabulous talking to you. And we spoke a little bit before I hit record, but I just want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about these incredible works, the Fauvism movement, and how it's impacted your work as well. Now, before I hit record, I said to you, there's something I want to chat to you about, because obviously you're an artist yourself, and it's clear throughout this episode, this movement's had an incredible impact on what you do. And so do you just want to, you know, tell people a little bit about what you do, and also explain to me what a speed artist / speed painter is, because I'm completely obsessed with what this is.
Oh, thank you, Joe. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, and it's been such a lovely opportunity to share my enthusiasm and passion for something that inspired me 20 odd years ago and still does, I should say. It's just as fresh now as it was then, and just the fact that I'm looking again at these pieces and thinking, gosh, they still have that sort of rebellious quality.
Amazing. They're just amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And I should say Jan was a complete rebel on every level as well, in the most wonderfully creative way. So yeah, I'm many things as an artist as well. I call myself, for want of a better term, a speed painter, which to me, it's not the idea of working against a clock, although occasionally I do, but it's in particularly in terms of my acrylic painting and that sort of thing, and life drawing and sketching, that sort of thing, I very much work with the idea of less is more. So I try to, a bit like we were saying earlier, the idea of capturing movement, capturing that fleeting essence, is the idea of using the fewest marks or daubs of paint or whatever to capture the maximum meaning visually. And I think, like I was saying earlier, that I always feel, well, I often think of what Leonardo da Vinci said, and I often quote this to people when they, because I do a lot of painting live in public as well, and they often come up and say, "How do you know when it's finished?" And this is something that a lot of people, a lot of artists, don't seem to know when to finish, if you know what I mean. We'll go on and fiddle and fiddle and fiddle. Leonardo da Vinci said, "Art is never finished, it is only abandoned." And that quote I love because, I mean, when I first read it, I thought, what on earth does he mean? The more I have painted, the more I have done art myself, I've come to understand exactly what he means. It's sort of, it's a sense of, if you carry on and you add more and you fiddle and fiddle and you find yourself fiddling with a painting or something, and you're not sort of adding any more meaning to it, you're just sort of fiddling with it, eventually it's, you sort of kill it, you know, you've sort of lost that original energy and impetus that inspired it. And so, I mean, to me, the ideal is speed painting, is the ideal of just capturing the that fleeting impression in as few marks as possible. And often that can be like 20 minutes, or, you know, it could be 20 seconds, or it could be an hour. I typically stand painting live in public, and I'll do, you know, a portrait or something in about 45 minutes, maybe an hour. And yeah, people are quite blown away by that. I've often had people say, you know, "I just went away to get a cup of tea and I come back and you've finished." That's
That's incredible. That's
I have a YouTube channel which I've created very much to share the creative process, to sort of demystify it, if you like, because I think a lot of people are slightly intimidated by the artist, you know, the archetypal artist who labors away, as you mentioned right at the start, Joe, you know, shut away in their own four walls, slightly isolated from the world around them. To me, I mean, I've always, certainly in the last 10, 15 years, I've very much been a community artist. I've worked live in part in public. I actively engage people, you know, in conversation while I work. So, you know, I often hear people say, "Oh, look, it's an artist, you better not disturb her." And I say to them, "Come here, come over and talk to me,"
I
you know.
love that.
They're
I
really
love that.
surprised by that and quite amused. But I kind of thrive on that. People often in that context, they will not only tell me anecdotes about how they've maybe had a go at painting, but they'll tell me their whole life stories. It's so sweet. And that often indirectly flows into the artwork and the creative process. At the other end of the scale, I do the paper cutting, which is very intricate work with a scalpel, a surgical scalpel, like a surgeon uses. Cutting out of paper, very different style to Matisse's work, I should say, on that level. My paper cuts tend to be very, very intricate. And I think that's my Virgo side coming out. And I like to sort of balance myself out a little bit. But even my paper cuts tend to be based on a very loose sketch, usually coloured pencil on the back of the paper, or sometimes the front, if I don't mind the pencil mark showing. Which has taken, you know, a few minutes to just capture that fleeting essence that I have, you know, mentioned several times. So once again, it's the sense of not being too precise. Even when you've got something that's very precise, you start with that very fleeting, very fluent energy. And I think the other reason I've really got into that sort of aspect of it was because I studied Arabic at Edinburgh University, and the cascading energy of Arabic is something that still influences, I think, my every mark making in, you know, in brush, in pencil, in scalpel paper cut. And it's that sort of beautiful flowing line that Arabic calligraphy has. My parents were absolutely shocked when I did Arabic, but it was, again, it was me sort of not wanting to be ferried off down a very narrow route of being told, this is how you do it, this is how you don't do it in art. And the number of people I've met over the years, artists who have gone through that very formal training, I've often heard them say to me, Lois, it's so refreshing to see how free you are when you paint. Because, you know, when I went to art school, I was taught, this is right, this is wrong, this is how you do it. And they say, I now feel so inhibited that I really struggle to paint in my own style. And I think that has, you know, that's very, really sad to hear. But yeah, like I've said, I try very much to share art with everybody, you know. And like, I think, Joe, you said to me before we started recording that you like to bring art out of this sort of very precious sort of so yeah, to bring it to a much wider audience, to show that it doesn't have to be something that's sort of kept in stuffy little art galleries and never brought out onto the wider public.
Well, I think that leads very beautifully to my final question. Now, I don't know if you've ever listened to the podcast. It's not a requirement. Do not worry.
I haven't. No, not yet.
There's with lots of episodes. There's, oh my goodness, at the time of recording, there's about 70 plus now of longer episodes, short episodes. But in my longer episodes in my previous seasons, I always end every episode by asking each guest one question. Oh. And it can be quite a mean question, and you can take it as specific to you as you want or as large and general as you wish. And that question is, why is art important?
Gosh, how can it not be? I think I'll turn the question back on you. How can it not be important? It is. I think art is the meaning of just about everything. I think people talk about not just art in a visual sense or in a musical sense or whatever, but art can apply to every aspect, every level of life. And I think the art of living itself is something that to me is fundamental to everything I do. And I mean, art is one of those terms that is indefinable. We can't pin it down, because it's just so all encompassing. It's a bit like what we've been talking about, you know, trying to pin down the spirit. And if you try and pin down the spirit, you basically shatter it, because it becomes too fragile and brittle to survive. So you can't pin art down. It's something that is, it's sort of, to me, it's inherent in everything I do. And it's all about the sort of the balance of life, really. Yeah, to me, obviously, also, it is a career path. And, you know, I, for my sins, I earn a living out of what I create. So that can be quite a sort of funny sort of balance in its own right. To, on the one hand, you know, you have to balance the sort of the day to day trying to earn enough money from your art with the sort of the inspiration side of it, the creative process, the thinking beautiful thoughts sort of idea. I always remember Jan saying that one of his friends years ago had said to him, oh, it must be so wonderful to be an artist and spend all day sketching. And we both laughed so much about this, because that is something that every artist would love to do. But actually, in reality, you know, when you're a freelance artist, a lot of it is admin, emailing clients, phoning, you know, checking up.
It's, yeah,
it's, designing mock-ups and all this sort of thing. So there are so many aspects of it. But yeah, I mean, your question was, I'm trying to remember your exact question. Why is art important?
Why is
art? Why is art important? I think, I'm not sure if I've answered it, but I'm sort
I
of
think you
throwing it
have.
out there, I
I
guess.
definitely think you have. Yeah, it's how can it not be? It's part of expression, everyday life. No, I loved it. Thank you so much.
I think I'll just wrap up by saying that to me, the most mundane activities can be art forms. And I think one of the ones that I most enjoy, which a lot of people will find bizarre, is washing up. You know, the very idea of starting with a pile of chaos, you know, dirty, unwashed plates and bits of, you know, food and all sort of gunk all over them, and ending with this immaculate, clean pile of organized things that, you know, sparkle and shine and are beautiful again. And I think that to me is the sort of the gist of every art form. You know, you start with chaos and you end up with something that's very orderly and very beautiful. Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, said, "You must have chaos within you to give birth to a dancing star." And I think I might just end on that note, because that to me captures the very meaning of art in every form.
Oh, I loved that. Lois, thank you so, so much for coming on. I've loved chatting to you. It's been such a pleasure to spend a Friday night chatting to you and also just looking and talking about these incredible works of art. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Jo. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And there you have it, another episode of Jo's Art History Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please make sure to like, rate and subscribe. It does really help in letting other people find us. You can listen to Jo's Art History Podcast on any streaming platform, and you can also watch it in a video format on YouTube. If you would like to support the podcast in any way, I have now released an Amazon wish list, which you can also find in the show notes below. This will allow you to donate in part or purchase in full an art historical text that is of interest to me and that will help in research towards future episodes. And it would be really wonderful if you've listened to quite a lot of these, if you could buy that as a way of marking patronage towards the podcast. That would be brilliant. If you would like to get in touch, please do. It's always lovely to hear from people. You can email me, joesarthistory@gmail.com, or you can get in touch with me via Instagram, which is @joesarthistory, or you can search for my name, Jo McLaughlin, via Instagram, and you will find me there. That's all we have from the podcast this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'll remind you to keep learning, and remember, art is for all. Bye.